You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, is this microphone working? Can you all hear me in the back? Great. So you are in the pension session, and we have a fantastic session with a couple of papers and then a couple of great discussants. And so I'm just going to introduce how the session is going to go, and then I'll get out of the way. It's going to be very similar to what happened in the last panel, if you saw it, in the sense that the authors are going to present. We're going to have two discussants, each of whom are going to present their discussion, and then we will all assemble up on stage and ask each other questions, respond to questions from the audience as well. But I'm Dan Bergstresser. I'm from Brandeis University. We have two papers in this panel. The first is by Don Boyd, Gong Chen, and Yiming Yin. It's on public pension risk-sharing mechanisms. And in a nutshell, it's getting into the deep sensitivity that the specific design of risk-sharing arrangements can have on the allocation of risk in those plans. The second paper, so we'll go from the first paper directly to the second paper. It's by three authors, Jamie Lenny from the Bank of England, Byron Lutz from the Federal Reserve Board, Louise Shaner from the Hutchins Center here at Brookings. And it's a paper that I think is extremely important, and it, sort of a things are not quite as bad as they seem approach or take on the world of pension finance. And then we'll have two discussants. We have Dr. Laura Quinby from the Center on Retirement Research at Boston College, and we have Tom Aaron from Moody's. And so with that introduction out of the way, the one last thing that I would want to say is that if you are tweeting about this panel, there's a hashtag MuniFinance that you can use to tweet about this panel in a way that other people will be able to find. And so Don Boyd and Yiming Yin, take it away.
So I'm Don Boyd, and thank you all for being here, and thanks very much for the invitation to present here. I'm going to talk about two slides, and then my colleague Iman will take us through the heart of our work, the meat of it, most of which he has done. Our colleague Gang is in China and can't be here, but we have his support. We're going to talk about risk-sharing policies, as I think probably most people know, in the traditional defined benefit public pension plan. The employer bears all or most of the risks, meaning risks related to investment returns, longevity, inflation, typically risks that occur both during the members' working years and retirement years. Some public pension plans incorporate some sorts of risk sharing under which the employer and the plan members may each bear some of those risks. More governments may seek risk sharing in the future as a way to reduce plan costs and risks. Some of these mechanisms that allow sharing of risks or require sharing of risks essentially involve converting the risks. They don't make the risks go away. They convert the risks from an employer risk to a member risk. So if you will, a COLA adjustment in – we use COLA in quotes, cost of living adjustment. It's in quotes because many plans have escalators as opposed to true cost of living adjustments, may increase risk to the employee benefit risk in retirement years. It's essentially converting what may have been investment risk or other kinds of risks borne by the employer into the member risk. And employee contribution adjustments may convert those employer risks into risks borne by the employee during working years. There are some common triggers that have been used. I would say that risk sharing is not that common in U.S. plans, but to the extent they exist, there's some common triggers. One is related to the funded ratio of the plan falls below a certain level, may trigger an adjustment either to COLAs or employee contributions. and investment return adjustments. Probably one important note to make about something that's triggered by a funded ratio is implicitly that may capture all of the kinds of employer-borne risks, such as longevity, actuarial risks, as well as investment risk, where something triggered by an investment return may only would be directly related to investment returns. Designing appropriate risk-sharing policies requires understanding how they affect costs and the benefits and volatility of each, and also I think requires understanding other important issues related to intergenerational shifts and maybe behavioral incentives to affect how individuals, plans, and governments behave. We're not going to get to all of that, but we've begun to get at some of the costs and benefits and volatility. The policies themselves, their impacts depend upon uncertain future events, which we think is kind of a natural for stochastic analysis, the kind of analysis we've done, where we take into account varying investment returns in our models. And so we've adapted them, and Iman will talk about that, to address risk-sharing policies. Very little research has examined risk-sharing policies in this way. Some plans actually do use stochastic analysis in some of their own analyses, but we'd still say it's not common. And so Iman's going to talk about how we've examined several impacts of several selected kinds of risk-sharing policies and how they affect both employers and plan members. I want to say we're still in some fairly early stages. It's complicated stuff. There are some challenges in devising good measures. We're moving along. We're not done by any stretch of the imagination, but we've used a stochastic simulation model. With that, Iman will tell you all about it.
Okay. Thank you, Don. So we examined the potential impacts of risk-sharing mechanisms using a stochastic pension simulation model. So the pension model, the public pension we use in the model has a pretty typical demographic structure, and we assume that the pension plan is in a steady state, which means the overall demographic and the salary structure do not change from year to year. So this assumption greatly simplifies the calculation that involves contingent events while still allowing for valuable insights. So we assume a pretty typical benefit, very simple benefit policy structure, which only includes service retirement benefit. And we assume that all plan members retire at age 60. And we assume that the plan uses a 5-year asset smoothing procedure, and any investment gains and losses will be amortized over a 15-year period. And we assume a fixed employee contribution rate of 6%, and we assume there's no negative employer contribution, which means there's no withdrawal from the fund by the employer, even large surplus exists. So using the stochastic pension simulation model, we examined the baseline policy in which there is no risk-sharing mechanism and six risk-sharing policies which are constructed based on some real policies adopted by the pension plans in the U.S. And for all policies, we assume a constant inflation rate of 2% for all years. And in the baseline policy, we assume there is a 1.5% constant call-up, which does not fully keep up with the inflation rate. And among the six risk-sharing policies we examined, three of them are contingent call-up policies. So one of them is based on the investment return, so which a 2% call-up is granted if the prior year's investment return is greater than 7.5%, which is equal to the investment return assumed by the plan, and the zero COLA otherwise. And we have two continued COLA policies based on a funded ratio. In the first one, COLA is based on a simple funded ratio threshold of 90%. So 2% COLA is granted if funded ratio is above 90% and zero COLA otherwise. And in the second funded ratio based continued COLA policy, which is similar to the first one, but the COLA does not immediately drop to zero when the funding ratio falls below 90% is that it will gradually reduce to zero when the funding ratio is between 90% and 70%. So when conducting actuarial valuations for plans with continuing call policies, plan actuaries in practice usually use a deterministic COLA, which is actuarially equivalent to the uncertain future COLA, which can be different from plan to plan. So in our paper, in order to make the comparison across policies more straightforward, we use the same deterministic COLA, which is 1.5% for the valuations of all policies. So we also model the contingent employee contribution policy, which is after the Pennsylvania public school employee retirement system, in which the employee contribution is adjusted every 3 years by plus or minus 0.5% of payroll based on how the average investment return in the past 10 years is compared to a series of thresholds. And the maximum total adjustment is plus or minus 2% of payroll. And any upward adjustment to employee contribution rates will be reverted to zero if the funding ratio becomes 100% or higher. So we also model two complex COLA policies loosely after the South Dakota retirement system policies, which is pretty unique in the universe of public pension plans in the U.S. So two distinguishing features of the SDRS policy is that first, it uses fixed employee and employer contribution rates, and second, it adjusts annual COLA to achieve to achieve full funding, and the COLA is limited in the range of 0 to 2%. So this diagram summarizes how the COLA is determined in the stylized SDRS policy we have modeled. So first, it determines a baseline funding ratio using a baseline COLA of 1.5%. If that baseline funding ratio is greater than 100%, a 2% COLA is granted. But if that is less than 100%, the plan will calculate a restricted COLA, which, if assumed to be last forever, will result in a 100% funding ratio. But this COLA cannot go below zero. If the plan still cannot reach full funding, even with zero COLA, some corrective action will be required of the plan. So we modeled two hypothetical corrective action policies that involves contribution increases. So the first one is the slow repayment of underfunding, in which the contribution increases is calculated based on a 15-year amortization formula, and the additional contributions are equally split between employer and employees. And we also modeled a fast repayment policy, which is the same as the policy above, but the contribution is calculated based on a 5-year amortization formula. And we examine the impact on employer contributions and member benefits for a single cohort, and we examine the cost to employer, the short-term volatility of employer contributions, the lifetime value of benefit, and short-term volatility of member benefits. So here we show, before we show the CAS simulation results, we first show a deterministic asset shock scenario, which is constructed after the spirit of the Dodd-Frank stress testing scenario, where there's 24% investment loss in the second year, which is followed by a 3-year recovery period. And then investment return will stay at 7.5% for the remaining years. And we can see how the annual realized COLAs will change over time under these determinist policies. So then we examine the results of the stochastic scenario, where in each year, the investment return is drawn from a normal distribution with a long-term expected compound return of 7.5% and standard deviation of 12%. So this figure shows how different risk-sharing mechanisms will affect the overall COLA level. So the box plots represent the distributions of the 40-year compound annual COLA under different policies. And we can see that the return-based continuing COLA policy has the lowest medium COLA, which is mainly because it has a threshold of 7.5%. So the realized investment return will approximately distribute symmetrically around this threshold. And we can also see that for the two funding ratio-based COLA policies, the medium COLA level is higher than the baseline, but they will create substantial downward risk for lower long-term compound COLA. And for the two stylized self-set COLA policies, we can see that the medium COLAs are slightly higher than the baseline, but they also will create substantial downward risk, which is mainly driven by the corrective action under these policies. Here we present the results for the potential impact on the contribution cost to the employer, which is represented by the 40-year present value of the employer contribution. So the horizontal line is the medium cost, and the vertical axis is the 90th percentile of the cost, which is also associated with more adverse scenario in the simulation. And we can see that the return-based continuing COLA policy will create a lower long-term contribution cost to employer in the medium case, but the two funding ratio-based COLA policy will not, the cost under these two policies will not deviate a lot from the baseline case. But all the but under the 90th percentile case, all three policies will lead to moderate decrease in long-term employer contribution cost. And the two SDRS style policy will lead to much lower employer contribution cost, which is mainly due to the increase in contribution under the corrective action will be split between employer and employees. But even if we add the additional employee contribution back to the total cost, the total cost will be still slightly lower than those under the contingent COLA policies. So I can see that the contingent employee contribution will have very small impact on the employer contribution cost. And we also examine the short-term volatility of employer contributions, which is measured by the maximum employer contribution increase in a five-year period. Again, the horizontal line represent the medium, and the vertical axis represent the 90th percentile of the short-term increase. And we can see that the three continuing COLA policies will provide very limited protection against short-term volatility contribution volatility, and the two stylized self-set COLA policy will provide pretty strong reduction effect on the short-term contribution volatility. And again, the contingent employee contribution has very little impact on this. And then we turn to the impact on the member benefit. So first we look at the lifetime value of benefits for a single cohort, which starts at age 60 in year one. And we can see it under the three fund ratio-based continuing COLA policies. There can be substantial risk for lower lifetime benefit under the very adverse scenario, which is represented by the 10th percentile in a distribution. And the two SDRS policies will have similar impact on lifetime value of benefits compared to the three continuing COLA policies. We also examined the short-term volatility of member benefits under these policies. So all contingent COLA policies and SDRS policies will lead to substantial risk of decrease in real benefit over a short period of time. So if you only look at these four figures, you can see that it seems the SDRS policy, SDRS policies have much stronger cost reduction effect and volatility damping effect on employer contribution while having similar benefit, similar impact on benefit compared to other policies. But that only tells part of the story. Under the policies we examined, the SDRS policies will create both benefit risk for the retirees and the employee contribution risk for the active members. So for our preliminary conclusions, we see that the contingent COLA policies examined other than the stabilized SDRS policies will reduce volatility of employer contributions only marginally, and the impact of these policies can be more significant during dramatic market downturns than during the more normal market conditions. And the contingent COLA policies we examine can create a significant benefit risk for retirees. The contingent employee contribution policy we examine has very little impact on employee contribution. The South Dakota retirement system policy can have greater impact on employer contribution, but it will also create both benefit risk and employee contribution risks for plan members. So simply put, the specific design of risk sharing policies will have large effects on its impact, and it's very important to design risk sharing policies based on a better understanding of their long-term, based on their potential impacts. Okay, thank you.
Open? Where? Here you do it. Thank you. Thanks, Owen. Thank you, and so glad to be here and to be able to present this paper. This paper is joint work with Jamie Lenny, Byron Lutz, and myself. And the disclaimers. So Federal Reserve, can we get that moved? So the slides fit. They'll fix it. They'll see it in a second, I think. Meanwhile, you know what the disclaimers say. So the opinions expressed are those of the authors and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England. Okay, let me see if the next one works. Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to talk about state and local pensions. State and local government pensions are actually extremely important economic institutions in the United States. They have $4 trillion in assets, and they cover the retirement for 10 million retirees. As I'm sure you all know, the plans are not fully funded, right? And so that most of the work in this area has been about calculating how unfunded these plans are. And there's been a huge amount of interest in the fact that these plans are not fully funded, and that's led to really widespread concern that these plans are in a crisis, right? That they're about to default, that it's a huge not understood problem. And you hear that kind of talk from academics, from policymakers, from municipal bond participants. So what this paper does is to look at state and local pensions from a different perspective. We call this a public finance approach. For those of us who've been studying Social Security for a long time, we're sort of like looking at public pension plans in the way we look at Social Security, which is quite different. And so we don't actually ask what the unfunded liabilities are. We ask whether or not the plans are sustainable, and if they're not sustainable, what needs to be done in order to make them sustainable. Okay. So in a preview of our conclusions, we find that in the aggregate, pensions can be stabilized with moderate fiscal adjustments, assuming moderate asset return assumptions. And we'll talk about what all these things mean as I go. Stabilization is more costly when interest rates are really low like they are now, but it's also less pressing to act sooner. And, of course, there is a lot of heterogeneity across the plans. Most of the results I'm going to show you today are for aggregating across plans that we think are representative of the United States. But there is a lot of heterogeneity, and some plans really are in a lot of trouble. Okay. So to calculate funding for state and local pension plans. So unfunded liabilities are just the present value of the liabilities less the assets. So what's the present value of liabilities? You need to choose a discount rate. That's where a lot of the debate has been. What is the right discount rate to discount liabilities? The pension plans themselves use the expected rate of return on risky assets, which is a pretty high discount rate. Others argue that you should use a risk-free rate, with the argument being that since these promises can't be changed, and we can talk about whether or not that's exactly true, but to some extent, these promises can't be changed, and therefore you should use a risk-free rate. And that's what Novi, Marks, and Rao have done, and you hear very large estimates of what the unfunded liabilities are when you use that low rate. And others argue for something in between, a low-risk corporate rate, which is what the Bureau of Economic Analysis uses and the Federal Reserve uses when it's doing its financial accounts. Okay, so how funded are they? So on the left side of the graph, you see how funded they are using their own interest rate assumptions. On the right side, you see using this AAA corporate rate. So you can see no matter how you look at it, they're not fully funded right now. On the left side, using the risky rate, they were about fully funded around in 2000. They've come down, and they're maybe around 80% now. On the right side, they're about 50% funded. And one of the things that I think is important for our paper is to look at the fact that they've never been fully funded. So that's not a new thing. If you're using a lower interest rate, they've never used that interest rate, so they've never actually been fully funded at that rate. Okay, so what are we going to do? So in order to analyze sustainability, what does it mean sustainable? It means that you can continue paying out your benefits without going bankrupt, basically, without needing any effusion of funds. In order to analyze sustainability, we need cash flows. And so what we do is the actuarial reports provide the liability and all the actuarial assumptions, and we reverse engineer the cash flows like Josh Rao and Novi Marks have done, like Byron and I did for a paper on retiree health. We collect all the data on current employees, their age, their years of service, their withdrawal, and all the things that go into predicting what the projection of earnings and eventual benefits are going to be. We then sort of take that statistical machinery. We start with the current workforce, and we age the workforce, and we have people quitting, and people, you know, all the things that go into it. And we calculate on our own what we get the unfunded liability to be using the plan's assumptions, right? So we use the plan's assumptions. We calculate our liability. We match. We say, well, how well did we do compared to what the actuaries say? In fact, on average, we do pretty well. That took a lot of work. This is really hard to do. But on average, we got to about a zero error. But plan by plan, we're not exactly at zero. Mostly, they're pretty small. There are a few that are not that small. And so we calibrate the benefit so that we match the actuaries. Once we've done that, so we'll say, well, actually, benefits are X percent higher than we think. Once we've done that, then we can change the assumptions and use our own assumptions across the plans. So we can use our own inflation assumptions, asset return assumptions, productivity growth assumptions. We actually add increases in life expectancy, which most plans don't do. So we think it's sort of a better but conservative in some sense forecast, because we're going to say that pensions are going to be higher because people will be living longer. We actually then, to do sort of a Social Security analysis, what we want to do is to look at how pensions are evolving as a share of the size of the economy. So we have to predict the economy. And so we take local demographics and productivity growth, and we predict the economy. We assume that places that are growing faster continue to growing faster, but eventually merge with national averages. And then we add new hires every year, assuming that the share of employment in the economy is the same, state and local doesn't change. So when people leave and there's population growth, we assume there's new hires that come in. All right, so we're basically creating this, you know, sim world of the state and local pension world, right? Sim city. So what are our data? So the Boston PPD has fantastic data, thank you very much, that we use, the Boston Retirement Center. We use all the actuarial evaluations from all the reports. We have a sample of 40 plans. That is not the whole universe, but it was a lot of work, and we actually do pretty well in terms of coverage. And we chose a plan so that we hit sort of the means for the national averages. So this is just our estimation sample shows you in the middle column, and the public plans database for the whole entire is on the right, and you can see that we match pretty well on assets for liabilities, the unfunded liabilities, the total pension contributions. So we're kind of choosing a match sample. Okay. So here's where you start to look at some of the flows, which you don't usually see when we're looking at pensions, right? You only see present values. So this is what the flows look like. The top line is the ratio of beneficiaries to the active workforce. And then you can see the pieces. We have current retirees that are dying. We have active workers who are beginning to retire. We have new hires that are coming in and then eventually retire. And what's interesting, what made us feel good about like that we've done this right, is the rise in the ratio of beneficiaries to active workers is about 25%. It's almost exactly the same as Social Security's. So the ratio of beneficiaries to workforce is rising in the public sector because of aging. So they're facing the same kinds of problems that Social Security is. And that's how we're sort of approaching it. But if you look actually at the ratio of benefits to GDP, we were surprised by this result. So you see a little bit of a rise, right? And this is the aggregate benefits. So if you think that the number of people relative to your workforce is increasing the number of retirees, you might expect benefits to be rising in step, but they're not. They're rising much, much less. They rise about 9% over the next two decades instead of about 25%, which is what Social Security benefits increase at. And this is a share of GDP. And then they decline. And so from a plan's perspective, which is different from Social Security, from a plan's perspective, there is kind of a hump and then you get better, right? So you have this big increase that you can kind of smooth through to some extent. So why not? What happened? Where is this coming from? So, you know, we were confused and we put a lot of work in trying to say, is this plausible and where and what can you do? So one of the things is that plans have actually made a lot of changes. Like you hear that plans can't make changes, but they can. They can make changes to their COLAs, as we just heard. A lot of times COLAs are not guaranteed by law. They're set sort of ad hoc, or they're set something less now, set something less than inflation. And so that's one thing they've done. They've made benefits less generous for new hires. They've changed retirement ages. They've changed benefit formulas. So the black line is our baseline. The green line is what we would have had if we actually said everybody has all plans have a COLA equal to inflation. All right. So if you look at that green line, you can see the rise is about 25%. So if we didn't have these changes in COLAs over time, and it has to be changed, it's not just they never had it, they've had to have lowered them, then you would have seen about the same kind of rise in spending as Social Security. It comes down over time, not because of the COLAs, but because of the reforms for the new hires who eventually are a larger and larger percentage of the workforce. So it's not just now. They've been doing that over time. So now they have workforces, some who have a generous plan, but younger people who don't, right? So you put all those together and you see you get this kind of goes up and then comes down. The bottom blue line is in some sense a measure of what they would be paying out if there were no COLAs. Right? Now, not every plan can get rid of their COLAs, but a lot can. So this is just a measure of how big the COLA is. And so the COLA is a big deal, which is why it works very well with that paper before. The COLA is a really big deal, both for the beneficiaries, obviously, and for the plans. Okay, so now we want to evaluate sustainability. So to evaluate sustainability, we have to have an assumption for the asset returns. These plans do have assets. You're going to look at for them on a sort of cash flow basis. You need to be projecting what the returns on those assets are. The pension literature has either done a set of deterministic scenarios or some stochastic returns or risk adjusting asset returns. The whole question of risk adjusting is one we don't really want to get into. It's been, you know, fought a lot over. It's an unresolved debate. It's a debate that exists at the federal level as well. There's a debate over how do you score federal credit programs for student loans and things like that. And CBO, the official estimates don't risk adjust. They say, here's what we expect to get, and that's what we're always our budget. You know, when we do budget projections, we're doing expected what we expect to get. We don't say, oh, but what's the risk of those things? So CBO, the official estimates don't risk adjust for student loans and stuff. They also show you what a risk adjust would look like. So it's an open question. So what we're going to do today is actually just show you, we're going to discount the liabilities at a risk-free rate. It's fine. But what we're going to show you is different returns on the assets, right? We're going to sort of play on that front, right? We're going to show you under three returns, 1.5 real rate of return, which is the current risk-free rate, 5.5% real return, which is kind of the expected rate, which is what plans have realized since 2000, and a 3.5% real return, which is what we think of a middle ground, and we think it's a reasonable rate to use. And so that's kind of, we'll focus some of that stuff on some of our exhibits with that rate. Okay, so one way of assessing sustainability is to look at exhaustion. And so this is if plans do nothing. So if plans do nothing, then at 5.5% returns are never exhausted. At At a 1.5% rate of return, they're exhausted, but on average, this is the U.S. as a plan as a whole aggregating, but not for 30 years. And at 3.5%, they do eventually get exhausted, but not for 50 years. So they're not sustainable at a 1.5% and 3.5% rate. Something will have to happen eventually. And then the question is, what do they have to do in order not to ever hit that exhaustion? Okay, so we actually do three stabilization exercises. You could sort of think about all kinds of different pathways that would say that would qualify as sustainable. So the first one we do, which we don't focus on too much because we don't think it's a great exercise, but it's interesting to look at, is to say, imagine that you said whatever your implicit debt to GDP ratio is, and what's your implicit to debt is the difference between what you owe and what you have. It's like it's almost like you have debt, right? It's implicit, not explicit. So imagine that you said, just like the Federal Reserve, the federal government, we say, well, as long as the debt to GDP ratio is 77, as long as it stays there, we're fine. So this says, you take whatever you start with today and don't let it change. You make contributions every year, so you keep that implicit debt to GDP ratio constant. The second one allows for sort of more smoothing. And so one thing is to say, what you want to do is reach some steady state. I just want to make sure that eventually we're gonna stop increasing our debt, that it's going to level off and we'll be in a stable situation. And we say, okay, what would you have to do today? One-time increase in contributions that you maintain, and we call it a contribution, but of course it could be a change in the benefits, a change in a COLA. There's a lot of ways to get there. But thinking about it as contributions, what would you have to do so you eventually get to equilibrium? And in equilibrium, what is your contribution? It has to equal to whatever benefits are accruing, plus the interest, minus the growth rate of the economy, that's important, on the implicit debt, right? So if you want to keep your debt equal to as a share of the economy, you have to pay interest, except you don't have to. If your economy grows, then your debt can grow also without the debt to GDP ratio rising. Okay. Third, to say, look, that's a nice idea, but who knows when you're going to hit it. What if we want to just be a little bit more, focused and say, look, today's debt to GDP ratio is completely sustainable. There's some dynamics over time. Let's make sure in 30 years we're still at today's debt to GDP ratio, or we get back to it. Right? So that's sort of just like more of a target. It's a kind of exercise that you will hear CBO do for the federal debt. How do we make sure that our federal debt is no higher today than it is in 30 years than it is today? Okay. Here's the annual contributions to maintain the constant implicit debt to GDP ratio. And so at different rates of return. So with this, because I showed you that the benefits go up and then the benefits go down, then your contribution has to first go up and then it can go down. At 3.5% of real return, you increase funding about 8% of payroll. Okay, so 8% of payroll is not nothing, but it's not a crisis. Okay, at 1.5%, you have to do much larger increases, about 18% of payroll. Okay, is this optimal policy? Doing this go up high a lot and then go down? Probably not. Probably they should be smoothing. So let me show you two smoothing exercises. So I'm going to take back the 2 minutes that Matt Klein gave to society. I'm going to take it back. here's the numbers to contribute to stabilize the implicit debt eventually, right? It just so says, if you do this now and you keep your contribution up, you will never run out of money, right? You will be fine from that metric, and you will always be able to pay everything. So at 1.5% of rate of return, you have to increase contributions about 13% of payroll, so that's a little bit less than before because you're doing some smoothing. But also, we say, what happens if you start in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years? Like, what if they don't act right now? How bad is this? Is this a crisis? They better act today? Well, if you believe that the interest rates are really low and that's the right rate of return to use in pensions, then it really doesn't matter when you act, right? So you shouldn't act today because you don't get anything for it. And that's kind of that R minus G dynamics, right? So there's all this, I'm sure you've all heard this whole question on the federal level about, boy, is debt free? Blanchard wrote this paper that debt may have no cost. So this is kind of bring it into the pension space, which is if you really want to take these really, really low returns, you get almost nothing for your money, and you should try to find better things to do with it, which we'll talk about it. At 3.5% return, that's not quite true. You have to contribute about 4% of payroll today, and it rises to 8%. So this one thing that's quite interesting about this is the lower the interest rate, so if you just take the present value of unfunded liabilities, the lower interest rate, the larger that number is, right? But it's also true, the lower that interest rate, the less it matters how quickly you act, right? So that's kind of interesting. So now I'm just going to show you that implicit debt to GDP returns to today's level. I don't have a lot. I'm running out of time, or I ran out of time. The numbers aren't that different if you act today, because frankly, you kind of get to the same debt to GDP ratio eventually as you are today in equilibrium anyhow. So these numbers aren't as different. Delaying makes a bigger difference. And the reason delaying makes a bigger difference is if you let your debt to GDP ratio go up and you say, oh, but you better get back, get back down eventually, then you're going to have to pay down the debt. And so that costs more, right? The first one says you didn't have to pay down the debt. Let me just show you this. These are the debt trajectories under the two assumptions. Under the first one, your debt goes up, and then you act, and you say, okay, now I've got to stabilize it, and you stabilize it. Under the second one, your debt goes up. It gets beyond your target, which is the black line. You have to pay it down. Now, if you kept on making those contributions enough to pay it down, you'd eventually sort of be fully funded, right? Because it's more than you need. Importantly, if I say I have to be fully funded in 30 years, then the numbers are much, much higher. These are the numbers that you hear about there's a crisis, right? It's going to be 35% of payroll at 1.5% if I act now. It's going to be 56% of payroll if I wait 10 years, right? And the idea is that you're asking to get to fully funding, so you're going to have to pay down all the legacy debt, all the debt that you've already acquired, and you're going to do it at very low interest rates, and it's going to be really, really big. So that's the big difference between our approach and this, like, implicit assumption that fully funding is the right thing to do. There is a lot of heterogeneity of cost plans. I'm way out of time. So if you look, you'll see that there are plans, especially at low interest rates, that do have a crisis kind of. They're going to be able to run out in 20 years. So this doesn't apply to all plans. And so my conclusions are, you know, approaching pension situation from a public finance angle suggests less of a crisis than is typically portrayed. And in aggregate, plans can be sustainable. We think are relatively modest changes in funding compared to what you hear about, really. And now the last point I just want to make is, so at really low rates of return, you know, the question is, what are they giving up but to fund pensions, right? Are they giving up investments in education and cleaning out lead and doing stuff that probably has much higher rates of return that would actually make their fiscal situation in the aggregate better? Thank you.
All right, great. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. I'm really excited to discuss these papers, and thanks to the authors for submitting them and giving me a chance to do so. So I was really excited by these, and you know, I read a lot of public pension papers, and I think this has the potential for a really great discussion. So why I got so excited is that the two papers present really different visions for the future of public pensions. So the first paper that we heard kind of assumes that governments are going to take actions to try to reduce their pension costs, probably by adopting some alternative plan designs, some risk-sharing plan designs. But the second paper argues that actually the plans are sustainable with just minor fiscal adjustments, drawing on lessons from public economics and public finance. They show that full funding is actually not necessary for fiscal sustainability. So on the first paper, the authors show how these shared risk designs affect contributions and benefits. And they consider two design options that are linked to financial status, the first being variable COLAs, and the second being variable employee contribution rates. And the outcomes they consider include plan cost, which I'm going to get to in a moment, and volatility. And by cost, they define this as the present discounted value of contributions over a 40-year period. And for volatility, they're looking at the probability that either contributions or benefits reach some undesirable targets. And the key fact that I drew out of this paper is that seemingly small differences in plan design actually have a very large effect on outcomes. But the first question I had when I was reading this was whether the party that pays a high contribution rate is actually bearing pension costs in practice. And the reason I wondered this is that the paper defines costs in a purely accounting sense. So whoever gets assigned the contribution on paper is the one that's bearing the cost. But in economics, we tend to think that the incidence of pension contributions, so who's really bearing the cost, is going to depend on the relative bargaining power of employer and employees. And so what do I mean by that? Well, an increase in employer contributions could well lead to a wage freeze in the next round of negotiations. And so really, it's the employees who are bearing the cost of that. And an increase in the employee contribution is going to make it harder for governments to recruit and retain highly skilled workers, which could in turn push them to either increase wages, or it could reduce the quality of public services so that ultimately taxpayers are bearing the cost of this. And I was also wondering how these risk-sharing designs transfer pension wealth across generations. So currently the paper shows how benefits vary over time for a single cohort of retirees, and it models contributions only over a 40-year horizon. And I actually suspect that many of these shared risk designs involve substantial transfers of wealth between different generations of retirees and taxpayers, depending on economic conditions. And so I would like to encourage the authors to think about some other measures of intergenerational risk. You know, I've put a few of them here. There are others that you can think about. You might think about the variance in the deferred compensation received by different cohorts of public employees, where I'm defining deferred compensation as the present value of benefits received minus contributions paid into the system. You could also think about the variance in employer contributions made by different cohorts of taxpayers. Now, why am I so worried about intergenerational risk? It's because linking benefits to pension funding can really burden transition cohorts when plans move from pay-as-you-go to fully funded systems. So the figure that I've put up here is the inception date or the birth date of the state and local pensions in our public plans database. And as you can see, basically, all of them were established before GASB came in and with statements 25 and subsequent statements sort of established what we would consider to be modern funding standards for these systems. And so for a long period of time, for a number of plans, including Massachusetts, where I'm from, these plans were operating without the regulatory environment that we have now. And actually, nearly two-thirds of them were not targeting full funding before the 1980s. So in 1978, there was a congressional committee that was looking into the fiscal health of state and local pension systems. And one of the things they looked at was what were the funding regimes in place at that time. And fully 17% of state and local pensions in 1978 were pay-go, purely pay-as-you-go systems, so no pre-funding. And then an additional 25% were pre-funding, but not on an actuarial basis. An additional 17% were only paying their normal cost, but were not actually trying to pay down any unfunded liabilities. So, you know, I agree with Louise here. These plans have been operating as partial pay-go systems for a very long time, and it's only fairly recently that we've been really starting to push for full funding in this space. So that brings me to the next paper, which really argues that plans can be fiscally sustainable without necessarily needing to be fully funded at all times. And what's interesting about this paper, and I think really fun, is that economists have debated optimal funding levels for a very long time, often in the context of Social Security, but also in the state and local pensions space. And the general conclusion here is that pensions can be fiscally sustainable if benefits can be paid without raising taxes or reducing other expenditures. And that happens when the tax base is growing at least as fast as the pension liability, and if the trust fund never exhausts its assets. A key finding of this paper is that benefit flows are at a peak right now due to cuts made post-2008. Now, the authors seemed a little nervous about this result in the draft paper that I read. But I have to say it passed a smell test for me. And the reason being that we've done work showing that most of state and local plans have made at least some cuts for new hires post-2008. 78% of state plans have made cuts. 55% of local plans have made cuts. And this figure here only goes through 2014, and there have been cuts after that. So, you know, some recent preliminary internal work we've been doing also seems to sort of corroborate this finding that benefits might be on their way down in the public sector. And the paper finds that you could increase contributions above what they are now by about 4 percentage points on average, and that would stabilize the unfunded liability to GDP nationally. Now, of course, you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity here. To become stable, some plans, the paper suggests, could even cut their contribution because they're trying to target full funding right now. Others are actually going to need to increase it quite a lot because they are not fiscally sustainable. They're not on a good trajectory. I did have a few questions, though. And the primary one was, how much of a funding buffer do we need to weather specifically state-specific economic shocks? So that 4 percentage point number, that's in aggregate. And so I really suggest that the authors test the sensitivity of their state-specific results to different trajectories for public employee payrolls, which ultimately is the basis for the contributions that are going into the system. You know, historically, we used to think, in particular, the authors make this assumption that the regional economies are all going to converge over time. We used to think that that was true. I think there's a lot more question about that in recent work, and so I would reconsider that assumption. And I'm also wondering, what happens if state economies respond to pension funding requirements? So, for example, pension costs could affect future benefits through wages, as I mentioned earlier. They could also affect tax revenues through migration. And so if you have a plan that needs to make significant contributions to try to become fiscally stable, that could actually trigger changes to their tax base. And so I think that's an important consideration to think about in some of these plans that are particularly in difficulty. I'm also a little unclear in my own mind, and so I'm sort of interested to hear what others have to think about this, how we as analysts should define a budgetary crisis. Now, the figure I've put up here is pension. The red line is what governments have actually contributed to their pension funds relative to own source revenue over time. This is from census data. And the gray line is their annual required contribution. You can see it's higher. And what struck me about these lines is that we're actually only about 2 percentage points higher now than we were in 1993. And so if you talk to budget analysts, they will definitely tell you, we feel that we are crunched. We are concerned about this trend. But from an economist's perspective, I see 2 percentage points, and I just can't get all that excited. So the question I have is, how do I as an economist, how should I be thinking about what is a crisis and what threshold should really be concerning to me? Taking a step back, and I am going to conclude because I'm running out of time, these two papers really highlighted how funding targets for public plans have evolved over time. So in 1978, we saw that many plans were not practicing actuarial prefunding. In 1996, GASB 25 amortized the UAL over a rolling 40-year period. In 2006, that same legislation automatically shortened the amortization period to a rolling 30 years. In 2008, the Government Accountability Office concluded that most analysts consider 80% to be a sound funding target. And fast forward to today, you know, many analysts are advocating for full funding over a relatively short period of time. So this is a fairly dramatic change in what we're telling the public plans that they need to target in terms of funding. And so I think that setting the proper funding target for state and local plans is actually a really crucial exercise, and that it needs to take into account several factors. I'm going to speed up here, but intergenerational equity, so which generation should pay the legacy costs of transitioning from a pay-as-you-go to a fully funded system, fiscal sustainability and benefit design. You know, one thing we haven't talked about here is that benefit design can actually have real implications for human resources in the public sector, and we need to think about that. As well as opportunity cost, do pension contributions yield a higher economic return than other forms of government spending? So how do we move forward? Well, we have a few ideas at the CRR. I'm just going to throw them out for the purposes of discussion. We would probably recommend that we fund legacy costs over a long period, but with a dedicated revenue stream. And then we would fund the normal cost using fairly conservative actuarial assumptions. This has two desirable properties. First, taxpayers are responsible for the services they receive, and retirees will receive the benefits they were promised. We would consider risk-sharing designs for the normal cost. But we would also reassess total compensation for new hires in the public sector. We need to set competitive wages to attract highly skilled workers, and in some cases that may require adjustments to the pension plan. One thing that we might recommend is aligning the normal retirement age with the private sector, which could alleviate some of this pension envy that often gets thrown around when we're talking about these things. And so with that, I am actually going to conclude because I am negative time. So thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Tom Aaron. I'm responsible for our pension analytics at Moody's Investor Service, the bond rating agency. And, you know, what I'd like to go through today and sort of the discussant role here, I thought I would start off almost titling this slide "In Defense of Full Funding," given some of the, you know, the sort of what I think is a really cool question, right? The one paper in particular really questions, well, is this fundamental premise actually worthwhile, right? And I think that's great. I think from the credit analyst perspective, right, and at Moody's, we're looking at risk to bonds, and that's the sole focus and the only lens that we really look at any of this through. I think the answer is, well, certainly full market value funding reduces risks to bondholders substantially and offers numerous benefits. So, you know, I'm just going to go through a couple examples. I think three kind of key reasons I say that. The first is full market value funding, and again, that would imply a discount rate at, you know, a high-grade fixed income market interest rate, you know, say 3.5 in this current environment. Well, that reduces reliance on future investment returns to cover current benefits as they're accruing. And just by way of example, to give you just a sense of the quantitative, you know, the impact we're talking about, for a California Highway Patrol pension today, the employer normal cost, the current present value of the benefit that is recognized under CalPERS 7% return assumption, is about 19% of payroll. Okay, drop that just down to 5. It's 40% of payroll, right? So that's a substantial difference in terms of just the interpretation of how valuable the pension is, and goes to show you the extent to which the current benefit being accrued, how much of that is really being assumed to be covered by future capital markets returns, particularly in a very low interest rate environment, right? 5% is higher than you're getting for high-grade fixed income today. So second, when you have assets and liabilities matched up, meaning, say, high-grade fixed income with projected cash flows coming in that match the benefit outflows of that comprise the pension benefits, you're immune to interest rate risks, right? Because both of those respond equally in present value terms to changes in interest rates. So that's a desirable way to lower risk, again, in defense of full funding. And then finally, we have this term, the generational equity argument, get thrown out a lot. But the way I would like to put it is, when you're fully funded on a market value basis, it prevents higher than expected costs from occurring at a very economically inopportune time. And so that's another way of saying you don't know that growth will be very good in perpetuity, right? You can't predict, you know, what will happen. Certainly, I don't think folks would have predicted some of the economic struggles that a city like Detroit would have had 25 years in advance of its bankruptcy. And so, you know, that's a key consideration, in that if you can't depend with certainty on that future revenue growth and the economic capacity to pay of the underlying tax base, well, then perhaps those benefits that today, if you're projecting them out, look arguably affordable, well, if that tax base evaporates, all of a sudden they may not be affordable. And if you haven't set aside the assets to pay for them, that can lead to real problems. And so from our perspective, you know, we look at pensions as really a must-pay obligation. And the key message here would be that if the pensions become truly unaffordable, well, we think the debt is unaffordable, meaning the bonds that we are rating. And, you know, in our opinion, the risks associated with public pensions to bondholders are higher than ever, but they really do vary significantly. I think that's a common theme across all the presenters here on our panel. And then to take a step back, you know, the discussion of, well, is there a crisis? Is there not? We have a very high investment grade rating on the vast majority of state and local governments, right? So that is basically kind of answering my own question. Well, yes, we view most of these as affordable, but that's not to say that there's not a lot in the tail that increasingly are facing a real challenge. And the way that we define sustainability, I think that's another key question raised by the authors here, is really service solvency. Because our observation is that when the government is no longer able to perform its core service functions, that's when you get bond defaults and restructurings. And we view unfunded pension liabilities as debt-like obligations and really a claim on future resources of the government. And as the cost to service these unfunded retirement benefits rises, the fixed costs that are facing a government, its debt, its retirement liabilities, can really crowd out its capacity to deliver on its current services. And, you know, in terms of looking at the sustainability question, again, from the perspective of credit quality for bonds, our observation is that bond defaults and or municipal restructurings tend to precede pension benefit defaults. And I've given you some examples here where, you know, these are all situations where bondholders have been impaired and the pensions either not cut at all or just a little bit. And so this is, you know, another way of I'm going to go through three slides that sort of get at the commentary that I think others have offered too, which is that we're sort of at this peak level of economic significance in terms of the liabilities and the costs. So this is just simply another way of depicting data that was shown by a couple other folks, scaling the size and scale of U.S. state and local government defined benefit pension assets versus the total liabilities. Now, this is scaled to GDP, right? So even though I heard one of the other panelists comment, well, we've never really been fully funded, right? The funded ratio has been, you know, as low or lower before. That's true. But we've never had liabilities this economically significant. We've never had unfunded liabilities this economically significant. And one thing I'm going to point out here, because I'm going to mention it in just a couple moments, notice how much of the assets is in corporate equities, right? That's highly – those are risky assets which, yes, carry higher returns than, say, fixed income, but also carry risk, right? Higher expected volatility than high-grade bonds. So the contributions today, more substantial than others. This is an example, state of Connecticut. This is its contributions relative to revenues into its teacher and its state employee retirement system. Okay, so it's hitting the budget harder than it's ever been. The unfunded liability is larger than it's ever been. And yes, the benefit outflows from U.S. public pension systems are expected to remain near peak levels of economic significance for about the next 20 years, right? And I think, you know, this is just a two-plan example, one in Illinois, one in Mississippi, but very clearly lines up with the findings that the other authors and presenters, you know, demonstrated here. In fact, in the light blue, which is Mississippi, you can see that benefit curve starts to come down even quicker than in the Illinois example. And so I guess considering all these things, I think there's a couple anecdotal pieces of evidence I'd offer. Pay-as-you-go can be affordable, right? So just paying the benefits directly. And we've got some examples of that. The city of Portland, its most substantial pension system for police and fire has been closed for a number of years. The city just funds that with a dedicated property tax levy. You know, they have a marginal level of assets, but that's effectively an example of a successful pay-as-you-go strategy. The state of Indiana's largest pension system by total liabilities, there's a little bit in the way of an asset base, but it's effectively PAYGO. Okay? But then we have other examples where it hasn't worked out so well. In the state of Kentucky, we've got the non-hazardous state employees retirement system. And while there's, again, some assets, the actuarial costs today that are being paid are effectively the equivalent to the PAYGO amount, if not actually a little bit more. And for the state budget, that thus far has worked out fine. But there's actually a participating employer in that system that had to file bankruptcy specifically to relieve itself from those pension costs. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. Okay, here we have a situation where it's actually been the bond defaults that have enabled the pensions to keep being paid and enabled the government to continue operating and delivering core services. So there, you know, the question of sustainability, well, sure, the pensions are still flowing, but the bonds are not being paid. And, you know, this is what I did here. This is the Dallas Police and Fire Retirement System. What I wanted to do is give an alternate take, I think, on some of the findings. And that is to talk about the fact that the path of returns and economic growth matters more than ever for U.S. public pensions. So a lot of the analyses we look at are on sort of more of a static basis, you know, assume static returns, assume that growth, you know, is relatively, consistent at some percentage per year. When you inject volatility both on the sort of underlying economy side and the investment return side, well, the results can be very different. And so what I've done here is if you just follow the green line, that's sort of a post-reform outlook for the city's expected contributions to its public safety pensions, based on a reform package relative to payroll, very flat. Then, however, if in the light blue you kind of follow what happens there, what I've done is I've kept the payroll growth the same, but then inject 7% average returns with volatility. Right? So some years you do a lot worse, some years you do a lot better. You can see, well, the assets deplete and the costs spike out into the future. And, you know, arguably, is that cost spike really that unaffordable? Well, relative to payroll, it's about the same as, you know, a little bit higher than what they're paying now. But then the third scenario not only stressed the investment returns and inject volatility, but then what I've done is simulate a near-term economic recession where the payroll base dips a little bit before then subsequently recovering. All of a sudden, that pension system is depleting a lot earlier, and when it depletes its assets, it's a lot more expensive than it is today. And the question there is, well, will that be affordable when that time comes? And the answer is, we don't know. That's a risk. Okay. And so the final point I'm going to make here is I, too, have run out of time like everybody else. I made the comment earlier, you know, pay attention to those assets. They're really equity heavy, right? So if the argument I'm making to you is that the path of investment returns and economic growth matters more than ever today because of the funding situation, right, the other observation is that if you look at the asset composition, the expected volatility is substantial because we've got low interest rates, so there's really no returns to be had on safe, high-grade fixed income. That's resulted in those assets being heavily weighted into equities and alternatives. So that requires the systems to accept a very high level of expected investment return volatility. So as I showed, you know, well, boy, a volatile return path with near-term losses could actually be a lot worse than this projected static path. Well, the assets are invested such that the likelihood of that occurring is actually pretty material. Right. And so with that, I'm going to close, and we'll move to the next section.
Actually, Tom, you don't get away that easily. So I, the authors, and the discussants are all going to come up on stage. And with the time that remains, what I want to do, I'm going to ask a question or two. Then I'm going to give the authors the opportunity, if they want, to respond to what I think were the very, very fine discussions that the two discussants gave. And then I will turn it over to you guys for questions that you have for any of us, for the authors, for the discussants, and we will proceed that way. So we're going to see if we can arrange ourselves a big party up here on the stage. And I will say, please remember, you will need to use your mics. Up on the stage, you'll need to use your mics in order to be heard. So the first question that I have, and I'll sit down and turn. And I'm going to ask this question somewhat provocatively or somewhat being a jerk maybe, but I'm going to ask you both up on the stage and also in the audience. I want to see a show of hands, right? And there are two options. Right, and the question. So you're going to have to raise your hand one time or another. The question is, if you could have a magic wand and start fresh, designing a retirement program for public employees, who would design? Who says, you know, if you could start fresh, you would design a retirement system that looks sort of like what we have now with publicly sponsored pensions and you know, these defined benefit plans and these COLAs? That's option one is, yeah, you'd build something that looks kind of like what we have now versus option two, which is state and local employees participate in Social Security. They can have 403Bs. They can have retirement arrangements that look a lot more like what we have in the private sector. So those are your two options. There are no other options. So you will. I'm sorry. I'm giving you a magic wand that you can kind of wave. So you can interpret that however you want with respect to a budget constraint. So who says? Yeah, you know, it makes pretty good sense to have all these states and localities arranging their own retirement systems, have this sort of public system like what we have now. Hands higher, please. Okay, so half of the panel, and it looks like about 30% of the room. Who says the alternative, the complement? Who says, you know, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense? And not it may make sense as a legacy system, but who says that if you could start fresh, you would not design a system like what we have now? Okay, so that's interesting. It's about half and half. With that sort of framing the responses of the authors to the discussants. I thought both of the authors did a great job. Do you want to take a minute, any of the four of you, and respond to the discussions of the papers that were just presented?
I have a bunch. Do you have a bunch? Go ahead, you're first.
Okay. Your paper's first. Boy, well, first of all, I love your paper. I love the work you put into it. I had the great benefit for the first roughly 15 years of my life of working with elected officials. So I've seen them make decisions, and I guess, you know, having seen them, and honestly, I have great respect for them too. I do. I have seen them decide that we don't want to pay the last payroll in this year. We'd rather use this year's revenue to pay for something new, and we'll just push it off to next year. I really imagining telling them, you don't really have to strive for full funding is, it strikes fear into my heart, I guess, is what I would say. And I think that you raised good points, and Laura raised excellent points about the notion that maybe we should be separating the legacy liability. It's a very different matter how you deal with this problem versus how you deal with paying for it on an ongoing basis. I do think, by the way, quickly, there are ways to pay for a DB plan that are conservative that don't require you to switch away from the system, but we weren't given that choice. So
let me respond to that, and then I'm going to respond to it. So I get that. That's kind of that you get that a lot. Like, oh, you can't let these guys, don't tell them that, right? Because then they're going to make bad choices. So first of all, our paper is sort of like, what's the right thing to do? And not like, boy, don't tell them what the right thing to do is, because then they'll take it and run with it. The other thing is that we're actually saying, it's not from using sort of more conservative discount rates, what they're doing is kind of similar to what we're sort of advocating. So we're just saying that it's much more that people say the discount rate should be 1.5 and you have to be at full funding at 1.5. We're saying no, that's too much. So that's part of it. Laura, your comments were fantastic. Both of your comments were fantastic, actually. So we are planning, definitely, I didn't get time to it, but we definitely want to look at the sensitivity to migration. And from two perspectives, actually. One is maybe that we're having them very gradually move into national, because we don't think, if you're declining in population, you obviously can't decline in population forever. But maybe, we can play around with it. But the other question we have is to the plans that are in trouble, to what extent are they in trouble because of actions they've taken or because they've suffered bad demographic shocks, right? So Detroit might be just because they had, a China shock hurt pension plan sustainability. Not necessarily. So we want to look at that. The question about what is a crisis is a good idea. Is a great idea. It's hard to know. My view is when we think about what we should be telling pension plans, and when you think about state and local governments, that it may be that they want to get the newest toy. On the other hand, you do hear a lot of stories where there are things that are incredibly valuable, like getting lead out of water, out of the city's water, that have huge rates of return, that affect people's health, that affect inequality, that affect everything that's really, really important, and they can't do it because they've got to fund their pension fund, and we're telling them they're getting 1.5% rate of return. That's what they should be accounting for. That makes no sense, right? So that's kind of the issue. The other thing, Laura, I think one of the things that we don't know the answer to, which is when you take a plan that's in really bad shape, right, like a Puerto Rico, okay, what should they do? It's really not clear. It's like Greece. I mean, it's really that combination, which is if you're already in really bad shape and the measures you're going to take to try to get in better shape are going to make yourself in worse shape, right? You're going to raise taxes or lower public services. People are going to leave. You're going to get into the spiral. So I think there are some plans that basically need a bailout because there's nothing they personally can do or some sharing or some something, right? It's not that they can just go and make those changes. And I think that I think this question about sort of the risk of full funding and defending full funding. So I think there's two questions. One is, if you started a DB plan today, would you make it fully funded? And I think there's a discussion there. I'm not sure I would say you would have to be fully funded at all times, but that's my personal thing about whether or not state and local should have these really tight balanced budget constraints regardless of what they're doing. But the question is, on the legacy costs, if we say they're not fully funded today, if you're worried about driving out, essential public services, well, that's what trying to get to full funding at conservative rates would have to do, right? So that's the question. Do you say, now I'm not at full funding, so I better go cut school funding and raise taxes? Now, that's, to me, from a Moody's perspective, might not be the right thing for them to do. That might, if you're looking at the totality, say that's actually making them in worse financial shape, maybe make their pension funds better, but not as a totality.
Okay. Louise hit most of my thoughts, but I want to say major thanks to both discussants. Those were truly unusually high quality discussions. I learned multiple new facts, which almost never happens in a discussion, so that's great. To Laura, I will just say that she nailed a couple of the exact things that we want to do next in this paper. They're absolutely vital, the wages, the migration. And to Tom, I have just a couple thoughts. In terms of credit quality, I would simply note that two of our three stability exercises have the implicit pension debt to GDP held at their same level, either in 30 years or at all points in time. And that should imply no erosion in credit quality, at least to a first order. And I think it's important to note that about the two exercises. The third exercise is an asset smoothing exercise where you draw down your assets to get to a new situation where you've stabilized the debt. But two of them do not do that. I would also note that I have a lot of sympathy for your comment about the composition of the plan's assets right now, that they're in a very risky position. In fact, I think one of the implications of our work is that for the large number of plans who are going to be fiscally sustainable at conservative asset return assumptions, they may want to reconsider the choice to be in such a risky portfolio. So I think that's actually one of the implications of our work potentially. But thank you again.
So I also really appreciate the insightful comments given by the discussant. And I'd like to respond in particular to the comments by Laura about the intergenerational equity. I can agree more about the it is a very important issue. And actually, at any given point, the risk introduced by the risk sharing mechanisms are borne by mostly by the retirees, but the risk reduction are enjoyed by the active members and taxpayers, and especially in our South Dakota policy scenario, they have both risk for benefit risk for retirees and employee contribution risk for the active members. So it's very important to make the analysis more clear how different parties bear different levels of risk and design the risk based on their risk tolerance of different parties.
Yeah. And I'm going to put everybody on the spot again. And this is going to try to tie this panel in with the earlier panel, which I thought was a very fine panel on climate change. So Tom, I'm imagining that when you're doing your analysis of the pension situation, you sort of have a map of the United States and you look at all the places that might be underwater with respect to pensions and you say, well, we should be fine as long as we don't flood, we should be fine. Like, do you ever go across to the group that's thinking about climate change and look at the overlap between vulnerability in terms of pension and retirement exposure and vulnerability in terms of the other exposures, whether it's climate or exposure to disruptions in trade, the other things that we know are going on that might add to?
So the short answer is, you know, as part of our methodological frameworks in looking at credit risk, yes, it's, you know, I happen to look at pensions all day, but, you know, when we're looking at bond ratings, we consider a whole host of other factors. So, you know, we do have actually a team that is sort of looking at the ESG framework, so environmental, social, governance risks. It kind of, you know, specializes in that framework. So when it comes to sort of our end product in terms of, you know, ratings, the answer is absolutely yes. There's cross collaboration there. I happen to be a bit more siloed and focused just on this personally.
Okay, I want to turn it over to the audience. If there's one thing that I could ask, so an assistant is going to come around with a microphone, because this is being videotaped. Before you ask the question, would you identify yourself with your name and your affiliation, just so that people watching online know who you are? Helen. Yeah, Tracy.
Hi, Tracy Gordon, Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. First of all, thank you all so much. This is a great panel, and I'm just a huge fan of all of your work. I'm just struck by an analogy. When I was an undergraduate and studied health economics, I was very influenced by the work of Victor Fuchs, who talked about marginal benefit equals marginal cost. And when you're in a healthcare situation, there's a point at which you just want any treatment where the marginal benefit is positive and you're not necessarily thinking about marginal benefit versus marginal cost, and certainly from a social rather than a private perspective. I'm just wondering if we're asking credit rating agencies and sort of the bond market vigilantes to do too much, because rightly so, people are worried about getting their money back, about getting paid. They're not necessarily, notwithstanding these wonderful efforts to think about ESG and sort of a broader set of factors, at the end of the day, it's very hard to think about the long-term vitality and ability of a community to thrive beyond just a balance sheet approach. And that's sort of the question that you guys are asking in your paper. So I guess in a way, it almost seems unfair to sort of ask bond watchers to equate marginal benefit and marginal cost, or is that an incorrect analogy on my part?
I don't know. I appreciate that you are acknowledging we kind of have a tough job, so thanks. you know, I think there's probably, you know, I like to think that we try and start from that more balance sheet approach that you've described, where you have sort of a quantitative input that you can really wrap your arms around. And it's the interpretation that's more nuanced and, you know, in some cases can arguably be more art than science. You know, oftentimes, you know, I'll even get asked, you know, well, okay, I put up a slide there that says there's $5 trillion of unfunded liabilities. How can you say that on one hand, but then say you rate the vast majority of state and local governments very high investment grade? You know, that, you know, what are you doing there? And the answer is, well, we are considering a lot of that nuance, right? And the fact being that these are governments with extraordinary ability to raise revenue, manage expenditures down, and for the most part do have longer time horizons than, say, a corporate, right? And if you think about our job in terms of giving the bond community an idea about the credit risk they're undertaking, right, what we're seeking to do is to signal to the market, if they're holding a corporate bond, giving them an idea of how risky that corporate bond is relative to a government bond. And our median corporate bond is rated BA1. That's actually below investment grade. So, you know, I hope that's a long way of saying that yes, you know, you have to start with this quantitative measures, but I think there's a lot of secondary analysis and consideration of the inherent strengths of governments to manage their affairs and repay their debts as well that we undertake.
I'd just like to add something quickly to that. You know, I mean, the bond market, you know, looking out for the interests of bondholders or the security of bondholders, and there are a lot of other people at risk in this, taxpayers and beneficiaries of services. And so I think there are some things that are very broken about the system, about public pensions, that do not properly value costs, do not properly value liabilities, and therefore do not protect the interests of either taxpayers or service beneficiaries. So I think that expecting bondholders to be the vigilantes is probably, you know, incomplete at best.
I would say that I think that the notion that there is a choice between, you know, either we there are three things we can do. We pay the folks who have pension who we promise pension payments. We pay back the bonds, or we get rid of lead that's affecting the development of our school children. And I think that, you know, the third option is that you could raise taxes. And I think that the extent to which localities and states compete against each other in terms of trying to lure business, you think about Missouri versus Kansas deciding that they want to dial down some of the competition in terms of luring business. You know, I think one of the things that technology did for us is that it made it much easier for localities to compete on the basis of lower taxes, sort of reduced the cost of running that auction. And that is something that has, I think, sharpened the sense over time that the option of raising taxes is sort of off the table.
Josh Gottbaum, Brookings. This was a completely lovely set of papers, notwithstanding the ambivalence of some of the members of the panel towards the notion of traditional pensions. I thought the first paper did a wonderful job of suggesting that this isn't a binary decision of you either have them or you don't, that there are design features that matter. The issue I'd like to ask the panel to talk a little bit more about is the one that Laura raised, which is that in some cases, in fact, the majority of cases, plans did not have a full funding target for much of their history. It's also the case, as the Center for Retirement Research has mentioned multiple times, and you, Don, have adverted to on a couple of occasions, that even with the lower targets that the actuaries suggested, there were jurisdictions that simply didn't make the actuarially required contribution. And so I'm wondering the extent to which it is the case, or it's knowable the case, that those jurisdictions, Louise, that essentially didn't even do what the actuaries asked are at the high end of your distribution, and what your distribution might look like for those jurisdictions that did whatever it was that the actuaries asked.
I guess we'll have the same answer, which is what part of our plan is to try to sort of do that kind of forensic analysis, which I sort of mentioned a little bit on, you know, to what extent was it sort of shocks, you know, coming from external stuff, or to what extent was it bad decisions or bad or whatever, those kinds of decisions. We don't know that yet. To do that, we're going to have to, like, go back, take a plan, and sort of find its history, which is what something we'd like to do for exactly that reason.
Yes, precisely.
One related, sometimes what the actuaries asked was maybe not the right thing to ask also, and I would say Pew, Moody's, and Society of Actuaries have all done reports on that, and the fact that in one way or another, plans and governments may not even tread water, may not even keep things static when they make the contributions requested. So there's, I think, that element of it is important too.
I'm going to weigh in on this as well. I will strongly suspect that contribution history is going to play a large role in putting plans where they are today. I think that's what a lot of our research has shown, that it's really a primary factor in getting plans onto solid footing or landing some in really dire financial situation. This also gives me an opportunity to clarify my wand-waving position. I also agree. I think the binary is missing a few options. So I wish private sector 401ks were perfect in terms of design, and I wish that Social Security financing were perfect. And so I think if I could wave my wand, I would revisit our entire retirement income policy more holistically.
So the question about the contributions, I think, is a little bit – so I think that's probably right, but then the question is why. Was it – you may be that you're hit by a shock, and therefore what you do – for good reason is to say, I'm not going to spend, you know, fund my pension fund this, right? So in the recession, if you cut contributions, that's actually a sensible thing to do. So what we'd like to do is kind of go underneath. Was it just people who are like, you know, the bad stories about, you know, they're having a big party, or they're like, you know, ribbon cutting instead of, or is it because they were faced with difficult economic situations and therefore cut their contribution?
Yeah, and it is, I mean, most of the plans currently in poor shape are in locations that have been losing populations and to at least some extent have suffered negative economic shocks. So
one thing that both of these papers highlight to me, on the professor side, is that, you know, for a long time, the unit by which professors are evaluated is papers and books. I look at both of these papers and I see, you know, you have a contribution here that is actually a tool. You know, you're producing tools which, you know, and if you were to start fresh with a vision of what it is that professors produce, I think that the tools here are just as useful as the papers and allow people, a tool that allows people to plug in their own assumptions about the interest rates, about equity, excess returns on equity, inflation, all those things. And I think that thinking flexibly about the what we produce is important.
Hi, George Friedlander, Court Street Group. And Louise, you alluded to a little bit of this, and so did you, Dan. But my real worry about pensions has to do with a winner-loser type viewpoint in terms of, A, that we are going into a much larger infrastructure spending type environment, in significant part because of climate change, without choices, and that this, I fear, is going to run right smack into pension funding payments, that these are at the edges. They're not current service payments, but they're going to become spectacularly more important in an environment where the, as I said much earlier, bond borrowing in the muni market is not growing,
we're not paying for the increased infrastructure, and I fear that it's going to run right smack into the pension funding issue at some point.
I mean, I would just sort of say for a big picture, I think it's clear that there are like a lot of headwinds, right? So we have aging, we've got climate change, we have low productivity, low asset return environment makes it hard to prepare for things you might want to. So it's not that, like, when I say that it doesn't really help to do anything now, that's not a good thing. It's just that you're not getting much on your money if you assume really low asset returns. So I think that's, you know, those are all things that are lowering our wealth. And, you know, when you lower your wealth, your consumption has to get lowered in some way or another. And then there'll be the politics of how that all gets played out. And that's something that's, I think, way beyond just the state and local sector. I think that's kind of an economy-wide, you know, phenomenon.
Okay. I want to thank the audience. Great questions. I want to thank all of the participants on the panel. We will reconvene here at 4:30. Thank you.